Welcome to Liz Talks. I'm Liz, and I'm a nutritional therapy practitioner and best-selling author, but here I'm 0% professional and 100% mom, spouse, friend, and overanalyzer. We are going to talk food, beauty, family, fitness, mental health, friendship, marriage, and everything in between in this season of Liz Talks, and I'm so glad you're along for the ride. Remember, this is a podcast about thoughts, feelings, and opinions, and I definitely do not give individual, personal, or medical advice. This is episode 7, topic, therapy, EMDR, and ketamine. In case you missed it, episode 6 was all about my mental health journey and everyday strategies for managing mental health. I talked about panic attacks, heart palpitations, and breaking down, things I could have done that I didn't do, why meditation is a struggle and what I do instead, and my top 2 doable everyday strategies for managing mental health. Today, I'll talk about the not-so-everyday things I've done to manage mental health, including talk therapy and therapist shopping, EMDR, and intravenous ketamine therapy. And of course, a weekly overshare that's just a must-listen for anyone that's had to take an 18-month-old into an airplane bathroom. Now, before I begin, some updates and miscellany. We are back from vacation in Florida, and I'm just so glad we went, even though having an 18-month-old on a plane is a nightmare. I had so many responses to my airplane Instagram stories. They were really funny, I have to say. From parents who also said this is the worst age to take a flight. She was such a tornado. She was a devil in pigtails, but we kept a sense of humor about it, and so did most of the people around us. Now, I'm not the type to pass out earplugs and do advance apologies. We were all kids once, and it's just life when you're sandwiched together, hurtling through the atmosphere while strapped into a row of seats you can barely fit your butt into. But I do try to keep some control over my offspring, so it was a very active and exhausting 3-hour flight. We did put her hair in pigtails ahead of time. We felt like it was our only defense. People would fall in love with her before wishing I'd just given her some Benadryl before we got on the plane or something. And other than snacks, that was basically our only strategy. I never thought I'd wish for my child to stare at a screen for 3 hours. But once she reaches iPad age, I think we'll be able to travel by airplane again. Hopefully not again for a while. And as far as working out on vacation, I didn't train much on our trip. I usually don't, but I did do my daily fixes. The daily fixes are 5 groups of 5 different exercises. I've been talking about them on Instagram, a little bit here and in my emails that you can pull from. You can pull from any of them depending on your unique needs. They take like 5 minutes to do. You don't need any additional space or any equipment, and they are amazing for getting your body aligned and for getting your circulation flowing for the day. And they're free, so you can get them almost immediately via email when you sign up for emails at athleticmom.com. So in relation to that, here's a question that came in from one of my Daily Fix subscribers, and I thought it was really good. It's in response to my asking via some of the email follow-up, like, what are your limiting factors? In effect, what keeps you from doing the thing? And this person said, "Hi, I'm a questioner." She's referring to Gretchen Rubin's 4 Tendencies, which is a quiz I highly recommend everyone take. She says, "I'm a questioner with a 3-year-old and a 6-month-old. I find my brain power constantly bogged down by my kids, but mostly my 3-year-old, and all the things, questions, emotions, needs, etc. I find it hard to make a commitment that isn't a necessity." And my thoughts on that feedback, that question, I guess it's more feedback than a question, but my thoughts are, I get it. And I think when you're in that stage of life, the best thing you can do, and what worked for me, is building confidence and interest in something by doing really little things repeatedly. So I knew I needed to do something with some frequency that would help with my mobility and just my creakiness. I was just feeling so creaky and feeling a little bit stagnant. But at first, it certainly wasn't going to be an hour-long training session or something like that. It's hard enough to decide what breakfast is going to be, especially if you're low on sleep, which many of us are. So this is why I think we've created a good solution with the Daily Fix. It's so small, but it's as impactful as it could be in the time that you have. And you'll quickly memorize the moves, and doing it in 5 minutes in the morning is an action that will build confidence and interest while it gets some endorphins going. And after a bit, I think you'll want to do it because it'll be so clear that it's helpful. And when it comes to the Gretchen Rubin four tendencies, I am an obliger. So things are a little bit different for me as far as how I respond to expectations. But as a questioner, as someone who likes to gather data, why wouldn't you want to gather this kind of data on yourself? Does it work? How does it work? How do I feel after 3 or 5 or 7 days, or 2 or 4 or 6 if you're like an even number kind of person? What benefits come from establishing sort of an anchor habit? This is what I do when I can, adulting, right? Then I drink a glass of water and start the day. Something really, really simple. I think that's the beautiful thing about questioners is the perspective of not just I need all my questions answered, I need to understand everything about something before I can do it. It's a matter of looking at it as an opportunity to gather more data so you do know how it works for you or whether it's right for you to do. So I sort of look at the Daily Fixes as small bites. Your workout, your training session, your pickleball match or game, is it match like tennis? Your pickleball match, maybe that's, you know, the big meal. But these small bites, these movement like tapas, are so effective. And again, we've got 5 different sets of 5 to try, and you can have them all. If you go to athleticmom.com and put your email in there, you can have all 5. You don't have to pick one. So keep those questions coming. I love it. On to the show. I'll give another little disclaimer here, just as I did last episode, almost word for word. I am not speaking from authority about mental health. I'm speaking about my experiences. Mental health is such an individual journey, and the challenges we all have vary in scale, in intensity, and the strategies we need to address them. I do not claim to speak for everyone on any level, and I can freely admit that what I went through and how I navigated it is neither applicable to all nor helpful for everyone. I'm not a doctor, I'm not a therapist or psychiatrist or psychologist, I'm not even interviewing one, and the best help comes from someone who has a personal relationship with you. So I share my experiences in hopes that a tidbit, something in here will be helpful for someone, and that's all I can hope for. Again, not an expert. I'm just showing up here to talk about my experiences. And if you have additional information that you really want people to know, shoot me a message on Instagram or reply to one of my emails so I can read it, screenshot it, and share with the community. Now, last week, in addition to my mental health journey and what I navigated in my personal life, I talked about the everyday mental health stuff that has made the most difference to me. The things that don't require an appointment to do, a doctor to refill, or a paycheck to afford. Now, that's not saying they're better or more important than what I'll talk about today, but I do think that an at-home strategy is important while you wait for example, your next therapist appointment. So on that note, let's start with therapy. My first therapist experience, right around the time I was seeing the doctor who prescribed me medication for the first time, and you can listen to episode 6 if you missed that story. Well, actually, that was not my first therapist experience. I did see a therapist very briefly in college. It was very helpful, but I would call this probably my first therapist experience in my adult life. So I gave the first therapist a few appointments, but I never truly felt comfortable. There were certain questions she asked me that seemed important, but I just didn't feel comfortable answering. And maybe I wasn't ready, maybe it wasn't the right fit, whatever. It just didn't feel right. So I took a break from that because I did find some tools on my own, which again, I talked about in episode 6. But I knew I needed to find someone eventually, and that I needed to be accountable for that. And eventually, I ended up reading about something called EMDR, which stands for Eye Movement Desensitization and Reprocessing. And that's a modality that's used for PTSD and other psychological issues. And it really sounded interesting to me. It's meant to assist the recipient, I guess I'll call it, in reprocessing traumatic experiences. And physically, it looks like some kind of side-to-side stimulation. Usually it's tracking your practitioner's finger side-to-side with your eyes, or in my case, bilateral tapping on my leg, since I had trouble engaging while trying to track visually. And alongside this, the therapist will engage you in a dialogue intended to help you process your experiences. That's not the official description of EMDR. That's just what I remember of it. Oh, I believe some people consider this to be controversial, but again, as I said earlier, I'm not commenting as an expert, just as someone who has experienced this modality. And at the time, I was interested in trying it, and it sort of spurred me again to search for a therapist. So this sort of background search for different modalities that might be useful to me are what ended up nudging me to open up that search for a therapist again. So I did an internet search for therapists near me that were trained in EMDR. And I will admit, I came across the woman who is still my therapist years later, although I see her much less frequently now since I'm doing really well, I think, with the tools that I have and the tools that she gave me that we worked on together. But it's still always great to get a session. And I will say that there are times when I'm like, hey, can we sit down for an hour? I think I need a little maintenance, a little upkeep. But I found her because I Googled EMDR plus my city. And I thought her resume was good, of course, but I also thought that she was really tall, like me, and pretty. And I liked her name. In fact, it was the name I was holding on to if we ever had a second girl. So my second daughter is not really named after my therapist. It was already a name that was in my head that I loved, but I loved her name. So anyway, I thought, let's try this. Why not? And this therapist was just the right one. Now, therapist shopping is an interesting thing. In my experience, I think it was okay to try working with a few people to see who resonated most and who I could establish trust with. I do not think that just feeling uncomfortable with questions would have been a valid reason to pop around from therapist to therapist over and over again. I think if I simply couldn't find someone with whom I could dialogue, I would have needed to really look inside and see if I was ready or able to be open and vulnerable or willing to establish that level of trust that has to exist first. If I'd bounced around to 5 therapists and still didn't feel comfortable, I would have probably assessed whether it was just me unwilling or unable to be real and raw and dig. But finding someone fairly easily with the second therapist, someone that was really affirming, made me feel like doing a little shopping for the right person was the right thing to do. And I'm really grateful I did. So early on in our therapy, we tried EMDR, and here was my experience. Overall, from the beginning, I was like, oh, maybe this isn't it. Maybe I really thought this is what I needed, but there's something else that we need to be doing, whether cognitive behavioral therapy or any of the other modalities that she was trained in. But I did gain one phenomenal insight from EMDR, and I'm not sure I realized how profound this realization was at the time, but its importance has definitely grown over time. So we figured out what was going to work, right? The tracking the finger with my eyes wasn't working, so we switched to some bilateral tapping. And she was asking me these questions and giving me these prompts that were really interesting, but I felt like I wasn't quite getting there. I'm just so in my head, right? But I can't remember what she asked me or at what point we were in the therapy, but I had this visualization. I shot all the way out into the cosmos, like straight into outer space, the galaxies, the stars, the vastness of the universe. I really perceived that. I saw that. And then I shot all the way back into, right, the world, going micro, 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 all the way to the microscopic level, into the gut, into the trillions of organisms that live just in my body and every square inch of my gut, which is a total nutritional therapy practitioner, nutrition and wellness nerd thing to do. But I shot all the way out into the cosmos and then back into the world, into my body, into the complexity that lies within every inch of me. And I realized, holy moly, I will never have all the answers. And I had to get okay with that. I think for so long, I just felt like if I looked up one more thing, if I read one more study, if I connected a few more dots, then I would know exactly how to fill in the blank, parent, stay healthy, keep my kids well, keep all of the bad things in the world from descending upon us. And I realized in that moment that it was truly, and I had this concept in my head, but I got it. I internalized it with this visual that I was never going to grasp the full complexity of my own body, let alone the universe, let alone these little people that I'm in charge of. And I had to find a way to come to terms with that. And again, I'm not sure I realized how profound that imagery was in the moment, but it has continued to help me so, so much at various moments in life when I just feel like things are slipping through my grip and I have to realize I don't have a grip on them in the first place. I might think I do, but I need to let go. And whether you conceptualize this as an intellectual thing or let go and let God, whatever it is, the universe is so complex from a macro level and a micro level, and we will never, ever have all the answers. And we've got to figure out a way to align with that and be okay with that and live with those mysteries. So that was my EMDR experience. And we didn't continue with the modality. I felt like talking CBT and a couple other things that we did together were really the most powerful thing and what I needed. We really processed through a ton of things together. And I'm so grateful for this therapist and everything that she's done for me in my life. And she also was supportive of the next thing that I'm going to say. So next up, I'm going to talk about something that I've done twice, and that is intravenous ketamine therapy. Generally, the recommended course of treatments for ketamine therapy is more than two, particularly for people suffering from severe addiction, depression, or PTSD. But I made the choice to do it once and assess, and then try it again later. So I did it twice, and it was a good experience both times. I was introduced to the concept by a friend who raved about it, which is a play on words. Do you get it? And I was so, so curious about this intravenous ketamine. The only thing I'd ever heard about ketamine was like that it was a drug, right? And I'll talk about that in a second. And again, I'm not an expert. I would love to one day start doing interviews again and chat with someone who is an expert around ketamine, but that's far off for now. This is just my experience. So I did this intravenous ketamine therapy probably 3 years ago, and I've not really talked about it until now. I actually had a very interesting conversation a few weeks back, completely randomly, with someone I just happened to be in a natural body care store with, and out of nowhere, she happened to mention that she was starting a clinic that would offer ketamine in the future. So it just gave me this push, this nudge to talk about it on this podcast. I know it's been a while, but I feel like it's time to talk about it. So ketamine is an anesthetic, but it is being used off-label to treat depression and a few other things because it appears that physiologically it might bind to certain receptors in the brain and basically cause the activation of new connections, new pathways in the brain that can have profound effects on mood and cognition and depression, and for me, processing my experiences. And of course, this is a drug, right? It's believed to have addictive properties or known to have addictive properties. And so this is certainly not right for all. Although I think it's also interesting that it's also used off-label to treat addiction. And I'll talk about that in a few minutes, that I went to an addiction center for my second round with ketamine. I guess this just sort of represents the paradoxes of being human, right? So if you do explore this option for yourself, make sure wherever you go does a detailed evaluation and intake process to ensure it's a good choice for you, because I'm sure it is not a good choice for everyone, but for me it was. So remember, I had been diagnosed with depression and anxiety, and I believed very strongly at the time that daily medications were not my path in that moment. They're absolutely life-saving for many, but like many things, are probably not always prescribed as judiciously as they should be. And for me, I felt like I had more time before making that decision. And I wanted to know if I could build some resiliency, some new connections in my brain with this therapy. And I was wondering how that might change the overall picture going forward. So it wasn't like I declined medication and was just sitting at home, not actively trying to figure out how I could be the best version of myself mental health-wise. I really was doing a lot of research, doing a lot of trying of things, and I felt comfortable with that at the time. So after a detailed discussion with the first doctor who administered the therapy, we had a whole treatment plan and we moved forward with the first infusion. And the first infusion was very different from the second, at least as far as my surroundings. So I'm going to talk about that first. The first experience with ketamine I did in California. I was actually visiting the friend that told me about her experience with ketamine. And I happened to be on that side of the country, flew over to visit her, stay with her, and experience this at the same place she had gone. And that was what I felt most comfortable with, walking into the experience, knowing that someone else had been there, could describe it to me, had a positive experience, came out better than she went in, made me feel really comfortable with something that was very, very new. So this first experience in California was very California. It was very spa-like, very safe, very calming, much more expensive. And it was actually like almost a whole day process. I went in, I actually did some nutrient IVs before we even got to the ketamine, did some NAD, which is kind of something that people are talking about a lot more, particularly in the biohacking community. But I did an IV bag of that. It was very, very interesting. And when it was time for me to go back and do the ketamine, I had someone with me the entire time. It was in a very spa-like room, very calming. I got to pick music. I got to pick aromatherapy, all of that, and had a professional with me to monitor my vital signs and make sure everything was going well throughout the process. So it really just felt like a spa with intravenous drugs. So it was a wonderful experience. I came out, had a green juice, hung out for a couple of hours relaxing before I got picked up. Now, I believe after that experience was when I saw my therapist again, and she actually noticed some changes. And I'll talk about that in a second. But first I'll talk about my second experience. So my second experience, I think, was at least a couple of months after that. And it was actually at a local addiction center. So it was very basic. It was at a place that used ketamine off-label to assist people in recovering from addiction. So it was very basic. It was much more affordable. I still had to have a consult with a local doctor, the doctor at that particular addiction center. And, you know, I was in a recliner in a well-lit room that was just kind of very functional, medical equipment, vital signs being monitored, machines beeping, things like that. But it was actually still a really good experience because I knew what to expect. And I sort of needed that first experience to feel comfortable with the second experience, but I still feel like I got something out of it. And now for what you're probably wondering more than anything, what was the actual experience of a ketamine infusion like? Well, it was very interesting. Ketamine does cause you to, the descriptive word they use is to dissociate. It's dissociative. But I didn't feel like I was entirely separate from myself during the infusions. I did feel like I was able to sort of detach from the immediate emotional impact of the thoughts that I would generally have kind of looping and causing anxiety. I was able to sort of look at things in a more objective way, kind of looking at myself very curiously and for the very, just an interested, wanting to know more type of feeling. So I do remember, especially in the first one when the surroundings were fairly dark, and also in the second one when I would close my eyes, I would notice a sort of grid pattern above me, a kind of moving very quickly, but also staying fairly static, almost in the ceiling. So it was like this almost like river, like a technological river made out of a grid where it was just flowing along these little squares. And that makes absolutely no sense, but I totally see it in my head. It's sort of Fantasia quality stuff. But I just remember looking at that grid and just feeling like, wow, that's so interesting. And to me, that's kind of a sign of whatever was going on in my brain, whatever new connections were being made, or whatever impact the drug was having on me in that moment was sort of manifesting in this grid image that was kind of above me in the room. Or when I closed my eyes in the second experience, it was just kind of there within my line of sight. So it wasn't like I was tripping. Not that I've ever tripped before. I know there are other psychological modalities that involved hallucinogens like psilocybin, I believe, which is like the active compound in mushrooms. And I know people that have actually done things like mushrooms and ayahuasca, sort of not even just off-label, but also just completely unsupervised. And the experiences they've had are very, very different from this ketamine experience. There was no feeling of lack of control. There was no feeling of not knowing where I was or what I was doing. It was just a very interested sort of detachment from my emotional self and being able to look at myself with curiosity and with interest and maybe even with a more accurate view than I would have if I was doing some sort of self-assessment outside of that infusion state. So it really was interesting and just a really cool experience. And I think it lasted usually maybe between a half an hour to an hour. You sort of lose track of time. But if it's sort of a reflective state. And I imagine that sort of represents what's actually going on in the brain at that moment. And overall, I'm so glad I did this modality because it really did make a difference. I didn't leave a changed person immediately, but I did notice over time that I identified less with my stressors. I could look at things a little more objectively. My body felt more comfortable in scenarios where emotional stress would have quickly impacted me physically. And again, my therapist even noticed a difference, that I was calmer, that I was cooler, that I was talking about these things that were still important to me to work through, but in a more objective way. So I talk about these tools knowing that not everyone can make the trek to a therapist or spend the money on off-label treatments like this. I get that. And that's why the at-home stuff that I talked about in episode 6 is so, so important. That's why they got their own podcast, because these aren't all things that everybody should be doing all of them at any given moment. These are tools that are less accessible than the tools that I mentioned in the previous episode, the ones that don't require an appointment or a prescription or a lot of expense or even a lot of emotional capital. Sometimes it's hard to get out of the house and do something like this when you're really in the thick of it. So I hope that folks will use these two episodes, episode 6 and episode 7, together. You don't need to go get intravenous ketamine. Maybe you do. I don't know. It's actually not for me to say, but I don't want people to feel like something completely out of reach is the only thing that they need to be feel good in their own minds. So please go back and listen to episode 6. There's a lot more there that's doable on the day-to-day basis. So check that out. It is time for my weekly overshare. This is the story of a tornado baby on an airplane and the mom who was praying that she would not have a poopy diaper. Well, spoiler alert, she did have a poopy diaper, and I knew this was going to be interesting, but I did not know that it was the beginning of a slapstick comedy aboard a Southwest flight. So here we go. We sat at the front of the plane. So envision the entire plane can see me struggling. My husband was standing up to let me out because I was sitting by the window. We had the row to ourselves. Husband standing up to let me out. Next, we timed it poorly, right? The person that was in the bathroom was walking out of the bathroom, but my husband stood up before she could get past him. And then I was standing up to get out. So there were like three of us in a half a square foot of space trying to figure out like who, that type of thing. And I'm trying so hard to get out of my seat, but I realize both of my shoes are untied because the baby has been spinning around in circles on the floor between my feet and somehow managed to untie both of my shoes. So thanks, baby. And I literally cannot stop stepping on them. I can't move one foot to move the other foot to get off the laces from the other foot. And we're in this tiny traffic jam and I'm just apologizing while my toddler tries to rip my mask off yelling, hi to everyone on the plane. So at this point, everybody has to be looking up and I'm just trying not to think about it. So we make it out of this traffic jam and I make it over to the bathroom in the front of the plane where the flight attendant asks me if I'm going to do a poopy. And first of all, for whatever reason, I'm tired, I'm embarrassed, my shoes are untied, I don't know. I think she's asking me if I'm going to poop. So I'm very perplexed when she hands me a trash bag. Then I get it. I'm like, oh, right. Okay. But I still say, oh, I think I can get it in the toilet. To which she thinks I'm telling her I can get my own number two in the toilet. So she goes on to specify that it's actually for the baby's diaper, to which I say, and why am I still talking at this point? It feels pretty solid, so I think I can get it from the diaper to the toilet. Which, side note, am I the only one that knows you're supposed to put baby poop into the toilet and flush it, even from disposable diapers? You're supposed to dump the poop out and then roll up the diaper and dispose of it. No? Am I the only one that knows this? Okay, so the flight attendant and I finally get on the same page and I manage to wedge myself into this tiny, offensively tiny room where the baby immediately loses her mind, screaming and crying. And she is a very happy baby. What she's very good at is allowing her emotions to flow through her. And usually I like that and I appreciate it, but not in an airplane bathroom. And to make things worse, the second I get latched into the bathroom with the baby, I hear the pilot come out. So I'm like, oh my God, the pilot needs to go to the bathroom. This is just the worst situation of my life. And I'm sweating like crazy. And I have no idea how I'm supposed to change this toddler diaper. The changing table is not an option because you can't put tornadoes on changing tables, let alone changing tables half their size. So I sit myself, my butt on the toilet, put her in between my legs in front of me, and take off her diaper. And yes, it is a solid poop, and it immediately falls to the ground of the airplane bathroom, and I cannot find it visually. I cannot find it. So I immediately lift the toddler from the floor so she can't step on it. So here I am, toddler screaming with me, holding her up so her butt is eye level with me. Pilot waiting outside, airplane listening to this baby screaming in the bathroom, lost turd, poopy butt that still needs to be wiped, and wishing that I had just sent my husband to do this whole dirty task. So I manage, I don't even know how, to get her wiped, and I start feeling around the floor with my bare hands, just hoping and praying I hadn't stepped on this turd or dragged my shoelaces through it. And finally, I find it. And I won't go into details there, but it made it into the toilet. I managed to sanitize my hands and wipe and sanitize the floor by basically dousing it in hand sanitizer and wiping it down while holding this baby above my head, I swear to you. And I get the diaper in the bag she handed me, tie it up, and expel myself from that vortex and somehow make it back to my seat without crying. And this is why I will never fly with that baby again. Overshare out. And before I wrap up episode 7, can I please ask you to share this podcast? I know that there are more people like us out there that would find this show useful, but there is literally no better tool than word of mouth. And I need you. I really, really do. If you can post a screenshot of your podcast app when you're listening, post it to your social media, or share via email, or even just person to person, I would be so, so grateful. That's it for episode 7. I'll see you next week.